it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to episode 69 of the Talking Chop podcast. I am your host, Brad Rowland, and will be later joined on today's podcast by Matt Powers of Talking Chop to break down the 2017 MLB draft, or at least the first couple rounds of that from a Braves perspective. But we're coming to you live on this Tuesday afternoon. I know some odd timing for the podcast this week, as we normally record on Sunday nights, but there was seemed to be no point in recording on Sunday night when the draft was coming the following day. So a midweek-ish episode here featuring Matt. But before we get to Matt, we're gonna break down some storylines that have taken place over the last 8 or 9 days before we last have the podcast from a major league perspective, and hit a mailbag question as well at the end before we get to Matt. So bear with me on a what amounts to a solo show for most of this thing, but Matt is coming. I promise you won't be able to you will be able to escape my voice at some point in this podcast. So with that said, it is Tuesday, and there was a wild win for the Braves on Monday night. Mike Foltynewicz was dreadful in his performance. He allowed eight earned runs against the Washington Nationals, put the Braves in a pretty big hole early on in this game. But as the draft was taking place, I was actually on major league duty. I was the one person on the website sort of following things along on the recap side of things. And that was a fun game to watch and follow, even in the midst of the NBA Finals as well. As you could tell, I'm in NBA mode still. The Braves came back and won the game 11-10. The bullpen was very, very good, actually, outside of a near implosion from Jim Johnson in the ninth inning. But nice to see the Braves get back in the win column, just because of the fact that over the weekend, things did not go well at SunTrust Park with 3 losses over a 2-day span. So nice to see a win on Monday. Matt Adams was sort of the offensive star of that game, hitting 2 home runs. He continues to absolutely rake for the Braves. He has a slugging percentage of .607. That is not a misprint, .607. In 96 plate appearances since joining the Braves midseason with the trade from the Cardinals, has 8 home runs over that time period. He's been tremendous, and a lot of debates as to whether what his role is going to be once Freddie Freeman returns. But for now, he'll either be a great trade chip or a fantastic bench bat that can also play some corner outfield in a pinch. So Matt Adams has been killing it. Elsewhere, Nick Markakis is heating up after I first sort of reverse jinxed him last week. I did a column in the middle of last week talking about just how bad Markakis's power numbers were, and how basically it's been a disturbing trend for some time with Markakis on cue. He was fantastic the same night that I wrote that, and had a home run last night. Has been much, much better since then. So good to see him playing better, because the Braves do need that extra power with Freeman out of the lineup. Even with as good as Adams has been, Matt Kemp has trailed off a little bit. So any power that the Braves can unearth is a good thing right now, and Markakis has been better in the recent past. Also, since the last time we spoke on the podcast, Sean Newcomb made his first start as a major leaguer. He actually appears to be in the rotation moving forward as a result of it. Six and a third innings, 4 hits, one unearned run, 7 strikeouts, and for me, most importantly, only 2 walks. He was fantastic in that start last week. His breaking stuff was basically unhittable. That was sort of the feedback that we were getting after the game, and even as we watched it during the game, it was pretty clear how good Newcomb's stuff was in that start, and that was enough to earn him another start. Even if he had just been average, at least for me, he would have gotten a longer leash, because if you're going to bring up Sean Newcomb now, there's really no reason to bring him up as a spot start guy. That's territory that should be reserved for Matt Whistler and that kind of type of player at this point in time. Newcomb's ceiling is, of course, much, much higher than those guys, so if you're going to bring him up and begin his service time clock, go ahead and get him going and have him sort of be in the rotation for the foreseeable future. Bartolo Colon is still a consideration, but for me, You know, I'm on record with the big picture concerns about control with Newcomb. I talked about that a lot last week after he had been sort of announced as one of the pitchers for the doubleheader, at least on Twitter. But he was dialed in, clearly, in that first start. That provides some hope for some people that believe that focus issues have been his biggest concern. For me, I will not claim to know enough about Newcomb's makeup at this point in time to tell you whether that's true or not. I just see the numbers more than anything and the limited exposure that I've seen to him pitching. No one can live with a 5+/9 walk rate in the major leagues, and Newcomb has been that bad in Gwinnett. But if a lot of that can be traced to sort of focus issues, and maybe he'll be more dialed in at the major league level, that's something that makes some sense to me. I'm not sure I buy it necessarily, but the early returns are good, and he was very, very good in that first start. Just for the record, while we're here, Newcomb is scheduled to pitch on Friday at home against the Miami Marlins, so we'll see how that goes. But Miami's not the worst team to be facing right now as well, so we'll see if he looks as good, or at least nearly as good, in that second start. Bartolo Colon, as I mentioned, is on the DL with a quote-unquote left oblique strain. No one believes that, to be honest. I mean, there were some murmurs that Colon had actually been injured, but a lot of this felt like a dump to the DL to sort of get things settled down with Bartolo, just because he has not been very good this season. That's the kind way to put it. He was god-awful in his final start last Monday. He now has a 7.78 ERA with a 5.09 FIP on the season. Might be getting a little bit unlucky, obviously, if you based on that, on those numbers, but he really can't walk guys at all to succeed. You know, he's walking about 2.5 guys per 9 innings, which is just fine and honestly pretty good for most people. But with the way that Colon pitches, he just can't walk anybody, and that's one of the issues as well, is just kind of being eminently hittable at the age of 44. We'll see what kind of role he comes back in. It seems to be whispers that he could be back in the next week or two. Colon, I would probably start in the bullpen, to be honest with you. I think Ari Dickey has looked better in recent days, so no reason to panic there. And you know, taking a spot away from Sean Newcomb is not really an option, in my opinion, right now. So we'll see what happens there. But you know, if Colon comes off the DL and is ready to go, his role will be very, very interesting for the Braves. Just a couple more notes here. Eric O'Flaherty is on the DL now. Jason Hirsch has been recalled to take his spot. O'Flaherty is bad. There's no way around it at this point in time. A 7.85 ERA in 18 and a third innings and 22 appearances this season, has a 5.78 FIP. Over his last 106 major league appearances, about 77 innings, he has a 7.60 ERA over 3 seasons. A lot of that is injury related, as he was not a full-time participant in the 3 seasons, but still, it's kind of amazing that he even has a job, given that track record over a 3-year period, and sort of a not insufficient sample, not a huge sample either. You know, only 77 innings is not too much to speak of, but 106 appearances is not nothing, and he's bad at this point in time. I think we kind of all knew that coming in, but the strong spring apparently tricked the Braves, and I'll be interested to see if he ever comes back, to be honest, to join the bullpen, because he's been that bad this season. You know, his numbers against lefties are not quite as bad. There's at least an argument to be made that he could function as a pure left-handed specialist, but until that's actually his role, not a whole lot to talk about. I kind of like Jason Hirsch, for the record, just to get that on record here. His numbers are pretty good. Has a sneaky good arm. Of course, a top flight pedigree as a former top draft pick. Not a huge prospect at this point in time, given that I believe he's already 25 years old, but could be an intriguing bullpen arm, if nothing else. Lastly, in terms of news, Sean Rodriguez resumed baseball activities this week and could return this season, according to Brian Snicker, who was quoted as saying that it's possible, at least, that he could be returning, given the timetable of him resuming activities earlier than they probably would have thought. One of the most overlooked things this season, with how bad the bench has been, at least was early on, and it's really kind of continues to be, is the absence of Rodriguez, who was supposed to be sort of the ace bench player for the Braves. It was given a 2-year deal, almost $12 million total. Not huge money, but they were banking on having Sean Rodriguez this season. That would be really, really nice to have him around. That's one thing that's sort of makes this worth keeping an eye on a little bit closely. You know, this year probably doesn't matter in terms of him coming back in September or something like that, but he is signed for next year at not insufficient number, but about $5.5-6 million, and that's real money. He'll be on the roster, you know, unless something crazy happens or something gets traded, something like that with Rodriguez. But I've always kind of liked his profile. I don't really buy the bat from last year, but he'll be an interesting sort of utility guy moving forward. He could play a few places, has some pop, and we'll see what happens there. But something to be encouraged by in terms of his rehabilitation from the injury. Last thing to get to before we get to Matt Powers is going to be a mailbag question from Daniel Mack. He says, as we turn the page from the draft, which has not quite happened yet, by the way, as we record this on Tuesday, but as we look towards turning the page from the draft, what players on the Braves roster will be traded by the deadline? This is him talking. He says he wants to move Matt Kemp, Jim Johnson, Aroldis Vizcaino, Tyler Flowers, Adonis Garcia, and Brandon Phillips. And Jaime Garcia, I should say, as well. Anyway, it's an interesting topic. We talked about this sort of all the time, but because it's just me on the podcast, I wanted to sort of fire off my current takes on all these guys quickly. I'm on record as kind of just saying, in the overall sense, that there's basically nobody on this team that I wouldn't trade for the right price outside of, you know, Freddie Freeman's, I guess, off limits at this point, obviously. And Dansby Swanson's at least close. I'm sure you can envision a scenario where a team overpaid for him and you might want to do that, but I think the Braves would make him basically untouchable at this point. But aside from those guys, pretty easily could trade anybody on the roster for the right price. Matt Kemp, though, is a tough one because of the big salary and the fact that he has been playing well, but I don't think you're going to get really any value for Kemp at all, given the salary and the price. People seem to have forgotten this, but the Braves were able to get him for basically nothing because of the fact that the deal is not good on the surface. His contract is not good one. You know, the Braves have some help with that, but they were able to flip Hector Oliveira essentially for Matt Kemp, and that's a steal, obviously, because Kemp is at least playing. He's overpaid, but is a functional, positive offensive player, a bad defensive player, but still a guy who can bring you some value. I think he has more value to the Braves than he's going to be able to get in a trade, but I could be wrong on that. Just some sort of my take at this point. As far as the bullpen guys are concerned, Jim Johnson is interesting because he's been very, very good in his Braves stint, but has a $5 billion price tag next year that could be actually really a value in getting more for him in trade, being that he's cost-controlled. Relievers are volatile. I think Johnson's a little bit more safer than most people that are in the bullpen, but if you can get a huge offer for him, then you would take it. And Vizcaino's the guy that's always been too volatile for my taste, so if you can get anything of value for him, go ahead and do that, I would say. Tyler Flowers has been incredible this season. He has a WRC plus of 149 at this moment as we sit here in mid-June, which is pretty crazy. A 442 on base percentage. His BABIP is still very, very high, so I wouldn't necessarily buy the batting average and the on-base percentage, but there's been something of a light coming on for Flowers. He's definitely been one of the top, you know, 10 or 15 catchers in the league since even joining the Braves, before last season. So Flowers has been a revelation. I do think that if you could sell that high on him, if somebody actually buys this sort of renaissance as having him being a near all-star level player, maybe you could sell him at that price. But if not, he has a very, very cheap option, a $4 million club option for next year. And that actually, you know, would actually add value in a trade, but also adds value to the Braves, and that he could be a stopgap again next year, given how well he's played. That's a spot where Flowers is not the sexiest name in the world, but he is definitely a starting caliber catcher with this current level of play. And even when he regresses, I should say, because he's going to regress, he'll still be an above average catcher based on the league market as it is right now. As far as the two Garcias, Jaime has been very, very good lately, could fetch a haul in a trade. He's sort of the guy who I thought would be able to do that if he stayed healthy. No signs of injury stuff for him, and he's sort of turned the corner. Not a high-end guy, but with the way that some teams might be looking for pitching help that are contenders, he could fetch a real haul, and the Braves, I think, would be definitely up their alley to flip him for prospects, and considering the Braves are probably not going to be in the race by the time July rolls around, or at least mid to late July as we get near the trade deadline. Right now, you know, as far as the division's concerned, nobody's pulling away outside of the Nationals for second place, but if you look at the wild card standings, it's a much bleaker picture, and if the Braves can have that comfort in the fact that they're probably quote-unquote out of it, they could look to sell on guys like Garcia, even though he's been a vital part of the rotation to this point in time. Last but not least, Brandon Phillips has been a league average hitter, I would say, this season. You know, 97, 98 WRC plus, which is just fine. His defensive numbers are actually better than they were last year. He's been pretty good defensively, and obviously has a long track record of being good defensively, although that's slipped a little bit in his age. He's basically the perfect guy to trade, I would say, because he's basically making no money this season in terms of what the club would have to pay to acquire him. And I can't imagine he'll be back next year, given the way that this team is looking for a future, sort of looking towards the future. You know, Phillips has been a revelation, but I can't imagine like paying him real money next year to fill up a roster spot. So if you can get anything of value for him, go ahead and do that. Even if it's not Ozzie Albies, you could play Camargo at second base. You can call Jace Peterson up and sort of plug that gap. It's not to say that you give Phillips away for absolutely nothing, because he has been useful this year, but if you can get anything of real value, even like a B-plus prospect, go ahead and do that for Brandon Phillips, because he's probably not going to be able to a part of the long-term plans given his age and the position, et cetera, et cetera. So with that said, the Braves are back in action tonight as I record this, Tuesday night with R.A. Dickey against Joe Ross. I apologize for the midweek podcast, but here we are. The plan is to do another show on Sunday as normally scheduled. I'll be having to take a couple of weeks off at various times during the summer due to some travel constraints, but we'll kind of cross that bridge when we get there, and until then, we'll be here every week. So with that said, Matt Powers is going to join the program right now, and we'll sign off from there. So here's Matt and I talking about the MLB draft. Matt, thanks for coming and joining me today, man. What's going on?
Not much, just watching the draft right now. Took the day off of work to just sit around and watch the newest Braves join the organization. How about you?
About the same. I'm not quite as invested in the draft as you are, because this is your thing, which is why you're here, and I'm going to defer to you for the most part. But as of the time of this recording on Tuesday afternoon, the Braves have made 5 picks in the draft. Of course, 2 on Monday, and now 3 so far today on Tuesday. We can just run down them here if that's all right with you. The most recent pick was Mount Olive left-hander Bruce Zimmerman in the 5th round. Do you have any hot takes on Bruce Zimmerman? Because this is a name that I've never heard before in my life. So there you go.
He is probably the first guy drafted that I don't know that much about. I'm looking at his stat line, and of course, this is against very, very weak competition. It's very impressive. He's got 129 strikeouts in 99 innings. He was their Friday starter. He throws a fastball up to 92 from the left side with an average curve and change. He's going to get a chance to start maybe, but he's pure senior sign. He was drafted just because the money is run out and they're just trying to make the top 3 guys work money-wise.
Yeah, that was my big feeling when I saw the 4th round pick, which we get into here with Troy Bacon, because one thing that was notable, at least something that I could even dig up, is that he was not among Baseball America's top 500 draft picks in terms of prospects. That's not the end-all, be-all by any means, but a JUCO right-hander in the 4th round. What did you think of that? Was your first feeling that it was a cost saver, or is this a guy that you think is very interesting?
A little bit of both. He's definitely a cost saver for sure. But he's much more interesting than Zimmerman. He won't come at the same kind of discount Zimmerman is, but he had 59 strikeouts in 44 innings, of course, against JUCO competition. He wasn't my favorite JUCO pure reliever arm. Donny Diaz and a couple of the Alabama JUCO arms were definitely higher up as pure relievers for me. But this is a kid that throws 99, can get it up to 100 if he really tried to put it all in. But profiles as a middle reliever and should move fairly quick.
Yeah, well, I feel like this is a good place to ask you this question just in general. When people say that, I'm of course a novice draft person. When people say move quickly in terms of these kind of arms, even especially in relievers, how quick are you talking? Is that like a year or two from now? Is that the rare example when you're talking about guys who could be up in a few months? Like how fast in general would you say that actually means when you're saying that a guy can move quickly?
Probably a year or two, most likely, as a reliever. Relievers usually tend to move the fastest. I don't think with his level of competition. Now, if we're talking about a guy from the SEC, he could possibly be up this year because he's faced a high level of competition already. But for a JUCO guy, probably a year or two.
That makes sense. And I mean, a lot of people remember. I know I remember Joey Devine being up within months of him being drafted by the Braves. That course did not go so well, but that was the type of guy that they knew they were going to be getting there. We can get into these top 3 guys. At number 80 overall, is it Tarnock? Is that the
yes.
Right pronunciation? Okay, cool. A prep right-hander, a very intriguing guy. Apparently a very, very late riser and sort of a guy who was potentially looked at as a position player by some people, but it looks like he's going to be a pitcher. Is that right?
Yep, yeah, he was a shortstop all throughout up until his junior year. He got about 25 innings or so as a junior in high school. Then he really kind of took off as a pitcher last year over the summer when he was getting scouted a little bit more. And then he settled into more of a regular pitching role this year. I believe if he was going to go to the University of Tampa Division II, it was going to be as a two-way player to play shortstop. And I think he might actually prefer shortstop, but his future is definitely on the mound. He's an athletic, projectable, with a good frame, and he already throws up to 97, some reports of 98, I haven't really been able to verify anything higher than 97 myself, but with the fastball, it's just impressive at this point to imagine what he can become. I've seen the Jacob DeGrom comparison already dropped on him, and I've written up the full scouting report on Talking Chop.
Lots
of video in there.
Yeah, I mean, I would say definitely go look at that. I sort of breezed through that before we started recording here because I definitely trust your analysis. It's a name that people weren't expecting necessarily from what the reaction felt like, and people not necessarily ranking him as high as the Braves are taking him here. But it's important to note that you know, baseball, unlike basketball and football, you see a lot of differentiation. Is that probably what you would say is accurate? Because I think if somebody was drafted at number 80 in the NFL draft that wasn't supposed to go in that range, you might see a little bit more. A little bit more surprised, but in baseball, it doesn't really go quite that accurately. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, baseball is a little weird because you have the JUCO guys, the Division II, the Division III guys, then all these small high schools, and they're going up against small competition in some states. Plus, the seasons are really basically ongoing right up until and including on draft day, as there were even some college games going on yesterday.
For sure. I think for the audience that are like more like in my end of just kind of, you know, I'm a fan of the big league club, but I know a lot of audience on this podcast, so, you know, Road to Atlanta is definitely the deeper dive stuff on prospects. But for us, I think it's always important to sort of break things down in a simple manner. But anyway, we can get in these top two guys. Drew Waters was the number 41 overall pick, a prep outfielder from a local product from Etowah in Woodstock, was a UGA commitment, switch hitter. Looks like he's a pretty toolsy guy. What do you think about Drew Waters?
I love Waters. He's got five tool potential. I think he's going to be able to hit for some average. He's going to hit for some power. He's going to be able to run well, play very strong defense, has a huge arm. I mean, most likely can stick in center field. If he can't stick in center field, he's going to be a very good right fielder defensively. He's going to be probably middle of the order to slightly under middle of the order, number six type bat.
Is that what you would worry about him in general? Is the bat the most worrisome? I mean, I think most of the time it's whether you can hit or not is kind of what it comes down to. But if there's one thing you had to worry about with Powers, is it probably the bat or is it something else?
Probably the hit tool on the bat, yeah. I mean, I'm not overly worried about that. He has shown very well against good competition. He seems to be a kid that works hard, a kid that wants to succeed. So I wouldn't be as worried about his hit tool with the swing and miss as I would about some others. There's always going to be swing and miss with his bat, so the strikeouts are always going to be there, but I do expect him to be able to overcome that.
That makes sense completely. By the way, as we're talking here, Mark Bowman of MLB.com just actually tweeted that people can conservatively project that Wright and Waters should account for about three quarters of the Braves bonus pool, which is about $10 million. Does that sound about right to you? Is that a surprising number? I think people might be surprised at just how much of the total pool is accounted for by these top two guys.
Not at all, because the Wright bonus slot was about $5.7 million. The Waters bonus slot was about $1.6 million. So right there is 7.3, yep, without going over slot.
Which makes perfect sense. I just thought that was sort of topical because that was something that Mark Bowman said, and I think people would be surprised, but that's kind of, as you said, sort of the run of the mill and how you do business there, and that's how you can save money later so you can afford to pay these guys what they need to get paid. Last but not least, Kyle Wright, of course, is the big ticket guy here, number 5 overall pick from Vanderbilt. First, before we get into Kyle Wright, is there anything that you would have rather the Braves done in that spot? Because I guess at the top of the draft, it becomes, obviously, you have a lot more guys to choose from. So is there something that you would have projected as a better fit? I know a lot of the Talking Chop staff, sort of the consensus was that Wright was one of the best case scenarios. Were you in line with that as well?
Yeah, Wright, I had number 2 on my own board going in. The only guy he was behind, of course, was Hunter Green, who was never going to be a Brave. He was never going to get down to number 5. So Wright was always best case scenario, just a very polished, very projectable pitcher who's really done well against top competition. He's got everything that's needed to be a number 2 starter in a couple of years. Could even be more than that. And at the very worst, he should be at least a number 4 starter.
So people said this, and I'm wondering if you agree. Like, there's something to, you know, you mentioned projectable and sort of maybe a fast riser. You know, Vanderbilt's had some guys move quickly in the past, even going back with the Braves organization with Mike Minor. Is he a guy that you could see move quicker than most people might expect just because, of course, he is a polished college guy?
a little bit faster than some of the other college pitchers, but he's still going to be a guy that probably needs about 2 years. I expect sometime around draft day of 2019 to be around the time when he makes his debut, and I think even if he's ready a little bit before that, they might hold him off just because of service time and concerns like that.
Oh, for sure. That makes sense. And he's only 21 years old. He'll be 22 in October, so not an old guy even by the college standards, so plenty of projection in there. You mentioned him as a number two starter sort of in your mind. I think people might be surprised to hear, at least casual fans again, that you know, if you take a guy this high that you might not be putting the number one label on him. But you know, sort of talk about that as much as you possibly can, just kind of the trade-off that you're doing there by having the more projectable guy with a college pitcher versus maybe a higher upside guy from the high school ranks.
Well, it's not even that he can't be a number one. It's that the number one is probably the ultimate upside, where he'd have to put everything together to reach that point. And that's just not, like, it's not because of him. It's just an in general thing where you're not going to expect a player to put everything together and reach the best case scenario. But he's got that polish. He's kind of, in a way, he's a lot like Ian Anderson last year against guys like AJ Puck and Riley Pint. It's that he's the best combination of upside along with the probability of reaching that upside. So he's a potential number two starter. He's most likely going to be a number two, number three starter, which Anderson last year was probably number two, number three starter, who's probably going to be that. While someone like a Puck or Pint last year, they had that number one starter ultimate upside, but they were also significantly lower on their probability of reaching that, and that's kind of what Wright is.
Yeah, that's something I actually like personally, but I think people might be split on that, and that makes sense. But that's the kind of guy that I sort of enjoy when you're investing. And this kind of, I mean, listen, everybody's risky in the MLB draft, but at the same time, like, this is a guy who seems to be safer and one of the few guys that I actually had a pretty decent working knowledge of. Is there, before we get, I'll probably let you get out of here, is there one thing about Wright's, you know, sort of profile that you really like more than anything else?
That he's done it against the best competition in the country, in the SEC. He struggled this year, and it wasn't something that's specific to him. It's something that a lot of players in their draft year will do. They know, I'm going to be a high draft pick in a couple months, and everyone's here to look at me, so I'm just going to go out and try as hard as I can, which leads to overthrowing, which he was doing. He was running it up to 97, which is the top end of his velocity, quite regularly, and it was leading to him being a little bit more hittable, giving up a couple more walks than you'd like to see, and he was struggling because of that. But then he started to slow it down and realize that he could take something off. His command improved in the second half, and he just dominated after that point. So he made the adjustments on his own, probably with a little help from the coaching staff, and really looked like a guy that was worthy of that number one pick for the longest time.
Sounds like you're a pretty big fan of what the Braves did. Is that accurate? Like, how do you feel about the overall haul? I mean, obviously, it's still early. It's only five rounds, but for the most part, the guys that we all kind of know are going to be off the board at this point. So are you pretty happy with what the Braves did in their first five picks?
I'm very happy with it. Wright definitely would have taken him over anyone else at that point. Waters had a couple other guys slightly ahead of him, but he was definitely a guy I had at 38 on my own board, which, of course, is higher than 41, so you take that as a win every day. And then Tarnock, I had him a little lower than where the Braves took him, but I didn't have quite as much information as I had hoped, since he's still so new to pitching. But with what I did see, and I recognized that he had upside along with what I've seen after the fact, I'm definitely comfortable with that pick as well. The other picks, they're more about making the first three guys able to be signable.
Yep, and that makes perfect sense, and one of those things in the baseball draft that you have to worry about versus other sports, so it definitely becomes more of a managing process. Well, Matt, is there anything else you want to get out there? Please go ahead and do that, and if not, please plug your stuff, plug your Twitter, and tell people where they can find your stuff.
My Twitter is MattPowers31, at MattPowers31, and you can expect to maybe find a couple interesting prospects tomorrow, rounds 11, 12, 13, because the Braves will have a free $100,000 that's free from the bonus pool restrictions that they can give to a player. It's once you hit $100,001 where it starts to count into the bonus pools. So you might see them take a chance there.
Yeah, that's something definitely to monitor closely, and I'm sure Road to Atlanta will be breaking these guys down as well, and we'll touch on it a little bit more next week on the podcast, but I wanted to at least get out in front of this thing as it was going on. I really appreciate your flexibility. Go back and grind for Talking Chop, and please, everybody else, go follow follow Matt. He's doing great work, as well as all of our prospect guys on the draft. So thanks for coming on, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
As for everybody else, we'll be back again next week, so stay tuned for that.